At this time, it gives me great pleasure to introduce my good friend Frank E. from Arroyo Grande.
Good evening, everybody. My name's Frank E. I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Frank.
I'd like to welcome Adam to Alcoholics Anonymous. You, in my opinion, are the most important person in this room tonight. I don't like talking about my drunkalog. I just, I think drunkalogs should be kept for you and God and a sponsee. But I think it's important at a speaker meeting to talk about, you know, how I got here. And so I'll kind of jump around a little bit and tell you how I got here. I had a sobriety date in 1988. I stayed clean for 15 years. I went through a treatment center over in Fresno called the ARC. And at that time, they took care of they took care of everything. It was a detox center, a 30-day inpatient, and they had Alateen and Alitot. They had marriage counseling, so they kind of had an umbrella of everything. When I came into this program, I was duly addicted, having grand mal seizures. My detox was just horrendous. I remember having an angel, you know, at my bedside. It was a little old lady that every time I'd kind of come to, she'd be praying for me. And she's passed now. I got to be part of her life. She got to be part of my life. But I finished that 30-day inpatient program and found out that I had a oldest son who, at that time, he was 8, 9 years old. And he witnessed my addiction, and it affected him greatly. So we got him into a program to help him work through this, because some of the questions I just couldn't answer at that time. I was newly into this program and hadn't even started working the steps yet. On Thursdays they had a speaker meeting, and it was on site, and we would go to the speaker meeting, and I got to start meeting a lot of people from AA. And I ran into this old man that walked around with a cane. His name was Old Art, and back in those days, he had at that time, I think, probably had 30-something years sobriety, and I found out when, you know, I didn't want what he had. I really didn't. He was mean. He was just a terrible human being. And I didn't understand how he could have 30 years of sobriety. It's funny how life works out. He ended up becoming my grand sponsor. I ended up loving that man to the day that was the last time I seen him before he passed. But I stayed clean and sober for 15 years, working this program, sponsoring a lot of people, staying in service. Everything that they tell us to do, I pretty much did. I didn't do it perfect, but I did it. I would suit up and I would show up. When I was asked to chair a meeting, I would say yes. When I was asked to be in service, I would say yes. It's something that I never did, even in old sobriety. I never said no. And I think it really helped, through the whole process. I really do. I had some wonderful times. I met some wonderful friends. In my group that I had in treatment, there were 15 of us. After I got out, 15 years had passed. There was only two of them that were sober, and three of them were dead. And one of them, a really, really good friend of mine, Brian T. He owned a American Indian shop in Fresno. We we used to do so much together. We had both had boats, and we would take newcomers out on the lake and have barbecues with them, and just have a great time. Be able to work the program with them out on Bass Lake or Millerton Lake. It was wonderful, wonderful time. I at that time, which I had 34 years of working for PG&E, I was sent up to San Ramon to better my employment. And while I was up there in school, I was up there for 2 weeks in school, and about 6 months before that, my sponsor passed away. And my sponsor, literally, on his deathbed, told me to make sure, I want you to promise me you'll get a sponsor if I pass. And I said, oh, yes, I will. His name was Jim. And I said, yes, I will. I never got a sponsor when he passed. I used to have this great little fold-out book. It would accordion out. It had all my AA phone numbers and all my AA friends in it. And I remember throwing that thing away. Little things started happening. I stopped going to meetings. I stopped calling other alcoholics. And it only takes, 6 months to a year, and those people don't call you no more. They just, you lose contact with them. And for me, I thought that was okay. I had this big book full of knowledge, 15 years of sobriety. Hey, I can do this. I can do this on my own. So here I was, 2 weeks into this school, getting ready for this huge test. I mean, it was one of the biggest tests that I've ever taken in my career. And I went out with the guys the night before, and we all had dinner, and somebody had a shot of Cabo Wabo, and they set it in front of me. And there's a moment in every alcoholic's life that you have, there's nothing you can do about it. If you're not, if you're not working a program, if you're not spiritually fit, there's nothing you can do about it. I grabbed a hold of that shot of tequila, and the next thing I know, it hit my lips, and I could feel that warmness going through my body, and it was on. And I remember dropping the guys off and going to the liquor store and coming back with beer and tequila, and it just like I'd never stopped. The disease was just waiting over there in the corner for me, and it attacked one more time. And I took my test and I passed it barely, but I had the worst hangover that I've had than I could even remember. And I know that all my teachers were very disappointed because I smelled like liquor, and I hadn't drank in 15 years, so there was a lot of barfing, and there was a lot of throwing up, and there was a lot of foam coming out. I mean, it was ugly. I'd go to the bathroom two or three times during my test. It was just terrible. But I had called my wife before I come home. I was so ashamed what I had done, and I told her. She as soon as I called her and she picked up the phone, she goes, "What the hell's wrong?" I mean, she knew over the phone. I started crying, and I told her. I said I relapsed, and she said, "Get your ass home. Stop drinking and get your ass home." Well, I got my ass home, but I didn't stop drinking. That's what this disease does. It'll settle for you drunk, but it really wants you dead. That's the bottom line. And if you don't think so, just come to these rooms and listen to these stories. This is what happens. We fall from grace, and a lot of us don't come back. So I stayed out there floundering, trying to come back into this program, and I didn't want it, for one. I thought, well, okay, I've relapsed. I think I can drink like a gentleman. I think I can control this. Well, about 6-7 months went along, and me and my wife would go out and we'd have dinner and play pool with friends, and we'd go to the bar and everything would be cool. And I'd catch myself doing these weird little things like I used to do. Like we would get pitchers of beer and set them up on the wall. We'd be playing pool or shuffleboard and we'd get ready, and I'll purposely take my jacket and I'd hang it up way over on the side where nobody else's jacket was. So we get ready to leave, and I'd go, oh God, I forgot my jacket. I'd go back in and it'd be like this much of that pitcher left. And I'd grab my jacket and grab that pitcher and turn around and chug. I could not stand to leave liquor, you know, that I had paid for. It was gonna get drank. And I caught myself doing these little things. Coming home after the party was over and everybody else had gone to bed, and opening up the cabinets underneath the sink and pulling out gallon jugs of, you know, of burgundy wine that I just don't drink, but I would finish that son of a bitch off, and I'd be sitting there, laying there on the floor with puke coming all, you know, all over myself. And my wife would wake up and she goes, oh no, I'm not gonna go through this again. So what she did was she filed for divorce online. And she said, I want you out of this house. I want you out of my life. She goes, I can't do this again. I did it with my mom. She goes, and I did it with you once. And she goes, I can't do it again. And she worked for a company called Telco, and she was very high up in the company. And because of what I had done, it affected her internally, and she lost a ton of weight. She looked terrible. She was sick all the time. I didn't see that, you know, I just didn't see that. And I ended up being duly addicted. I ended up, it was really sad. I ended up homeless. I was working for PG&E still at the time, and I ended up homeless. I started sleeping in my PG&E truck. I started sneaking around doing some really crazy stuff, you know, selling generators to pay for my habits, selling stuff on my truck to get me through the day, you know, lying to my coworkers, doing drugs at work, drinking at work. It just, you know, and I thought I was getting away with it, but a lot of my coworkers, they seen it, and a couple of them confronted me in a C-van one day, and they said, we're really worried about you. And I give them that big speech, you know, get out of my life. You don't know what you're talking about. I got this under control, blah, blah, blah. You know, I ended up down on the west side at a crack house. And I don't remember going there. And I don't remember coming to. And I guess I was on a 3-day binge. I had lost. I had a $30,000 motorcycle that I had parked out front. When I woke up, it was gone. My wallet was gone, all my money was gone. I had been almost beaten to death. And when I woke up, I was laying face down in a puddle of puke. And when I woke up, it was gross, you know. I woke up and I had puke all over me, and I went into this bathroom. It had a cracked mirror, and I turned on the light, and I didn't recognize the person that I was looking at. I didn't know who that person was. My head was telling me that you can clean yourself up and you'll be all right. But I knew in the back of my head I needed to get my ass into some kind of treatment program. I can't do this on my own. I just can't. Left up to my own devices, I'd kill myself. So from the west side of Fresno, I walked down to a place called CAP. I don't know if anybody's ever heard that in Fresno. It's really a low-end recovery center, and it's bad. It's one of the worst recovery centers, I think, out there. But they had one bed, and I went in there, and I mean, even the bathroom was like an abandoned gas station bathroom. It was terrible. You know, the beds had bed bugs. It was gross. But it got me clean and away from alcohol and drugs, and they had a doctor on site, and they kept an eye on me 24/7 until I come down off of all this crap I had in my system. And I remember calling my wife and asking her, is there any way possible that I could possibly come back into the house? And she said no. She goes, you can't. So I started walking. I thought, well, I'm just going to walk home. You know, if I have to, I'll sleep in the garage. I don't have nowhere to go. I don't know what to do. And I had asked a guy at this fellowship where my sponsor Al, where he came out of Sierra. I had asked him before I relapse if he'd be my sponsor, and he said, yeah, if you think you can get sober. In fact, he told me, I'll give you $20 and go out there until you get done, you know, and I didn't understand what that meant. So I had called my wife, and then I called him, and he asked me, where you at? And I said, well, I'm at a Standard gas station on the corner of Winery and I can't remember what, Ashland. I had walked from the west side, and my feet were just killing me, you know. I was so out of shape. Jeez, I'd lost so much weight. I was just so unhealthy. But he took me home, and he asked my wife if I could please, you know, stay here, and she was just livid. And I said, just let me sleep in the garage for a couple of days until I can get my shit together, get a game plan. And she goes, okay, that's fine. You can sleep in the garage, but you can't come into the house. And I slept in the garage for a couple of days, and I remember sneaking into the house, grabbing one of my guns and taking it out to the garage with me. And I remember on my knees saying that alcoholic prayer, God, please help me. And I put that gun to my mouth, and I pulled the trigger, and all it did was went click. It was an old rotary 32. And just went click, and I remember throwing it down the corner of the garage, and I just started crying. I ended up going to sleep and waking up just tears, you know, dried tears down my eyes. And I called this gentleman that I asked to sponsor me, and he came over to the house, and he brought a sponsee with him, which actually was my boss at PG&E. You know, it was humbling, very humbling. And I remember his name was Jerry Fonciani, and I remember Jerry going, Mike, he goes, this gun's loaded, and he opened up the chamber, and the hammer hit the bullet, and it didn't go off. And he gave me that bullet, and he said, you might want to keep this. Well, I was freaked out. I figured it'd go off in my pocket, so I just set it, you know, in one of my cabinets. And Mike ended up taking me to a halfway house, and I stayed in there for about 3 weeks. And then my wife called me at the halfway house, and she says, honey, she goes, I'm going to make a deal with you. She goes, I'm going to draw up a contract. And she goes, I did this with my sponsor. My sponsor did this with my wife. He goes, I'm going to write up a contract, and if you can abide by it, you can come back into the house so you can get sober again. And I had to sign this contract, and that contract stated I would be to be drug tested at any time, and if I had dirty drug tests or alcohol in my system, that she would file for the divorce would be sent, and I would be out of that house and signed everything over to her. I would just be penniless, you know, after 35 years of working in the same company, and I agreed to this. I agreed to it. I came into the program. I put my sorry ass up against the wall, and at Sierra Fellowship, and I called myself a newcomer one more time. Now that was December 17th of 2005. By the grace of God, I'll be celebrating 17 years this November. For this alcoholic, that's a gift. It's a gift from God. I stayed with this sponsor for right at 15 years, and I stayed very involved in Sierra Fellowship. My youngest, or my oldest son at that time, he started, I could tell the behavior, he started acting up. He was working at Save Mart. And he called me a couple of times, "Dad, I think I'm in trouble." I said, and then I met with him, and I went through, just like we talked in the program, I went through some of the stuff that we ask people who are using. I said, are you done? Are you ready to stop? You know, and he said, "I don't know." I said, "Well, if you have doubts, then you're not ready to stop." And I said, "When you get ready to stop and you think that you're done, give me a call." And I said, "We'll talk." Well, that just kept going for quite some time. I ended up, my mom had a business, a quilting business, long arm quilting. And I was brought up around sewing and quilting my whole life. My grandma and my mom would take me to quilting bees. They were Protestants, and it was a big deal. They'd all sit around this round table, and they'd have their quilt laid out, and they would be sewing and yakking, you know, and drinking coffee. And they'd put this needle in front of my face and said, "Here, sew this line." So, you know, I started sewing this line, and next thing you know, I'm doing a blanket stitch. Next thing you know, I'm doing a chain stitch. Next thing you know, I get my little kit. They give me a little kit, you know, that had needles and thread and all this shit in it. I thought I've arrived, you know what I'm saying? So during those many, many, many years, I did a lot of sewing, and I used to do some really beautiful stuff, a lot of handwork. I'm really good with my hands. And I found out, in sobriety, I found out that when I sewed, the committee upstairs sat down and shut up. And I thought, wow, this is so cool. You know, I can actually do something where everybody shuts up and I can actually think. So it was, it's a form of, it's a release, you know, for me. It's more of a meditation than anything else. I know it sounds kind of weird. I mean, it's a big guy riding motorcycles his whole life, you know, and he's on the back, he's sewing, you know what I'm saying? But that's kind of the way that started. So when my mom called and said, "Honey," she goes, "I need some help with this business." She goes, "I just can't do it on my own." Then she was 79, very spry, but she needed some help. She goes, "Would you consider taking this business over?" And she goes, I'll teach you anything that I know." And I got to thinking, that sounds pretty cool. And she goes, "I found a house up here that's down in the track that I live in." And she goes, "And they're getting ready to lose it." And she goes, I'll help you out, and you can move over here." And she goes, "And I'll give you your deed." And I thought, wow, live at the coast, you know, with a deed. So we put our house up for sale, and we sold it in 3 days. So there was a lot of God things that happened through this whole process, and I look back on it, and it was scary. It was really scary to move, you know, and come over here and leave all of my friends, you know, all of my sponsees, leave everything, you know, my sponsor, you know, leave all of that. And I said, "Man, I don't know if that's going to work." We went ahead and took the plunge, we took the step, and we came over here, and everything was going really great. My son had called me, and he goes, "Dad," he goes, "I'm in trouble." He had hit a light pole in a parking lot, and he was drunk on his ass. And he had been using drugs and drinking, and I said, "Well, again," I said, "Are you ready?" And he goes, "Dad, I'm ready." He goes, I'll do whatever you ask." And I said, "Well," I said, "as a father, we want to just rescue, you know." So I call my sponsor. That's the first thing I did. I called my sponsor. And he said, "Don't you dare get in that car and come over here." He goes, "Give me his full name and give me his phone number and tell him to meet me." He goes, at that time, the sponsor that I had, we would go out on Tuesdays, to a dinner, and then we'd go to a men's stag meeting, and then we would do breakfast on Saturday, and we'd go to a men's stag meeting. And it just happened to be Tuesday night, and he said, have him be at DeChico's in Clovis. And he goes, we'll engulf him in love. It was a really hard thing for me to do because I just wanted to drop that phone and get in that car and run over there and just grab a hold of him and just, you know, do it myself, you know, help him. I know I got all this knowledge in AA. I can do this. He said, don't. He goes, keep your ass at home. He goes, we'll take care of him. And it was the best decision that he ever gave me. And my son came. He got a sponsor that night. And he has that sponsor even today, even though he's not working the program. But he got sober for 8 years, and then he decided to do marijuana maintenance. And it's more of a, you know, a vape thing. Oh, I'm just vaping, you know, to do this. Yeah, right. It's to me, I mean, it's, you've lost your sobriety date in my eyes. You know, you've relapsed in my eyes. So if it's working for you, I mean, you know, I'm more power to you. So going back to my mom, this whole thing, I had done an amends with my mom about 5 years prior, and she was in Morro Bay at the time. So I wrote this amends out with my sponsor, and I had to rewrite it about 10 times. He goes, you're not thinking from your heart. You're thinking from your head. He goes, your heart is not involved in this amends. So it took a while for him to, you know, keep explaining to me what I was doing wrong. And then I remember praying about it and literally taking my head out of the equation and take it from my heart and put it down on paper. And he read it and he had tears coming down in his eyes. So I knew that I had done it right. And I did this amends with my mom on the beach in Morro Bay. She lived right across the street from the beach. We came back after it. She goes, oh, honey, you don't have to do that. She goes, I know you drink a little bit too much. She goes, oh, it's fine. You're okay. She goes, but thank you for all of that. She goes, I don't need it. I said, but I do. I need it. So we get back to the house. She makes me lunch, and I hear the famous noise of that that beer being twisted open. She comes in with my sandwich and a beer. I said, man, you don't get it. You know what would happen if I drank that beer? I would be off and running again. She goes, oh, no, honey, it's just a beer. And she had a glass of wine because she drank wine out of a box. You know, poured a little rubber hose and filled her right on up. You know, she'd come in there and sit down with me. And I said, Mom, I can't do this. She got me, and I took the beer, took it back in the kitchen and got a glass of water. She just didn't get it. She still doesn't get it to this day. Neither does my brother, my youngest brother, and his wife today. They don't understand Alcoholics Anonymous. They think that I have a choice, that I can quit on my own. And I've tried to tell them, explain to them that when I put alcohol to my lips, I lose that choice. You know, the disease takes over and it makes the choice for me. They don't understand that. They don't think I'm sick. I'm sick. I'm a very sick person. My relapse showed me what this disease does, and it almost killed me. God had another reason for me not dying that night. He really did. And it was to carry the message. It was to stay sober. It was to be there for my son and to be there for my wife. After the 1 year went by, I got my 1 year chip, and every year I get two chips. I get one for me, I get one for my wife, and I present her with that chip. She tore that contract up. Now, April the 17th of next year, we will be married 50 years. That's huge. And for this woman to stick by me all those years, I could not repay her in two lifetimes. That's unconditional love, in my opinion. I mean, I look at it like, because I've had a lot of animals in my life, animals give you unconditional love. And that's like my wife. She gave me unconditional love. She went through this with her mother. Her mother was a heroin addict all the time that she was growing up. My wife ended up taking care of her three siblings until I came and took her away when she was 16 years old. And she ran. She literally ran from the house out her bedroom window. So she had had enough of this disease. She had seen it on that side, and she had seen it on my side. She's a saint. She's had a lot of issues in the last 15 years. She had an accident at work, which at the time it didn't really affect her. She kind of shined it on, but she fell down. I was telling Andrea the story that she worked at a company and she was a will call driver, and she little bitty short thing. She's only about that tall. And they had these rails on this little flatbed truck, small truck, and she picked it up and the wind caught her and it pushed against her and she fell down, hit her neck on one of those concrete bumpers. And her neck was sore, you know, and she didn't think too much of it. But then as time progressed, she ended up literally going numb. Half of her body went numb and she was dragging her foot. So she had a nickname at work called Dragon Step. And she goes, that's it, because I'm going to have this worked on. So it took about a year, and they ended up putting this god-awful cage in her neck, going through the front, and they ended up fusing four vertebrae. So, and then she ended up later on in life having to do it to her lower back. So this is all starting to fail. It's been almost 15 years since this happened, and the doctor said the vertebrae below it, because of the weight, you're probably going to have issues. And she's starting to have issues with the one in the neck. So, but she's a trooper. She doesn't want to be addicted to anything. So she does take pain meds, but she just takes like the med and she cut it in force and takes a little piece of it only when she absolutely has to. And I don't know how she does it. I mean, me, they'd have to put an IV on me, you know what I mean? I get a paper cut, you know, and I'm crying the blues, you know what I'm saying? I don't know how she does it. But she's a loving woman, and she's my partner, and she's my business partner. So during this process, when I made my amend to my mom, it just went south. It really did. My mom come to the conclusion through my sponsor at that time. My mom's just one of the most hatefulest women on this planet, and there's nothing I can do. I wrote her a letter, and I wrote it with my sponsor's approval, and I told him, I said, I can't send this to her. He goes, you need to send that to her. I said, I can. I said, there's some stuff in here that she's just going to hate me for the rest of my life. He said, you have to. You got to let this go. You got to give it to her. I gave it to her, and it went just like I thought it was going to go. She literally just said, I don't want to have nothing to do with you no more. She ended up moving from Arroyo Grande and she went to Reno, which is just unheard of. She's in her high 80s now, almost 90 years old. She just moved last year. So I have no contact with her. I still send her birthday wishes, Christmas wishes. I call her, and it's real short and sweet. I still love my mom. She's my mom. I did everything that I could possibly do in Alcoholics Anonymous, and my sponsor says, just let it go. And that's pretty hard. Sometimes it's very hard. And through that process, I had this sponsor for 15 years, and we had rules when we went into this relationship. His wife and my wife, they were like sisters, for crying out loud. And the only rules we had: no religion and no politics. Everything else goes. Politics got brought up after 15 years, and it wasn't because of something that I did. It was just something that I liked on Facebook. So social media out there can really kick your butt. It really can. I didn't think that it would affect me and my wife and my relationship with my sponsor, because I didn't write it. I just liked it. I thumbs up. That's all I did, because I agreed with what this person said. I really did. And it was during this last presidential, I'm not going to go into that, but he threw me under the bus after 15 years. And it hurt me to no end. It hurt my wife. I can't sit here and tell you how much it hurt her. It hurt her so bad to have a friend after 15 years throw yourself under the bus, refuse to take your phone calls. I worked this out with my sponsor, and he said, Frank, you've done everything humanly possible. He goes, I can't think of anything else that you could possibly do. I had to let it go. So when I asked Al to be my sponsor, it was really hard for me to do that. And I remember the day that I asked him, and he said, yes, Frankie, he goes, it would be a privilege. That's huge. That's huge to this alcoholic. It's hard for me to ask for help. I don't know if you guys can identify with that. And I am a forgetter. I don't know if you are, but I am. I'm a forgetter. So that's why I have to keep in this program. I got to keep talking to people. I have to stay close. I have my routine that I have done, and I haven't deviated from it. I'm on my knees in the morning. I have my readings that I read every day. I don't deviate from them. I still look at my prayer for the day every day. It helps me start my day. And do I have bad days where I need to start my day over? You're damn right. A lot of times. It's person, places, and things that get in my way sometimes. It's that person when you get in your car and they cut you off. It's that person on the freeway that's, you look in your mirror and he's zigzagging through traffic, acting like a crazy person, you know? My mind tells me, you know, I'll just run him off the road, you know, or I'll chase his ass down. You know, that's what my mind tells me. I don't do it, but my mind, it's out to get me on a daily basis. I can't say enough about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hope you hear something in my story that you can identify with. I really do. I don't like talking about drunkologues a lot. It makes me anxious inside when I start talking about it, because when I'm the words that come out of my mouth, I got all of this video in the back of my head playing while I'm talking to you guys, and it's just, I don't like to watch that video playing again. It hurts, you know, it really does. Because when I came in 2005, I was carrying this bag of garbage that just, oh my God, in 1 year's time, I had more wreckage than you can possibly think of. I mean, I had a company that I worked for that fired me for crying out loud. How dare you? They had to, you know? I mean, they found out I was doing crap at work. I was drinking at work. You know, I was stealing their stuff. I mean, for crying out loud, I didn't have a choice. You know, I came back on two dirty drug tests. You're allowed one, but the second one, you come back with the second one, I mean, that's it. It's zero tolerance, and you're gone. So thank God that my wife is a saver, not a spender. And thank God that when I started all this back in 2003 and 4, that she locked me out of all of my bank accounts, all of my savings, all of my retirement, because I'd have got into it and I'd have spent every dime of it. That's just the way I am. I'm sneaky, conniving. It's just the way I am. You know what I mean? I don't know if you can identify with that, but that's just the way I am. When I'm out there using, man, look out. I'm going to weasel my ass into your pocketbook and back out. And man, I was weaseling myself out of my friend's pocketbooks. It just, oh, and I had to go back and make amends to all of that. I had to go back and make monetary amends and amends to my coworkers and PG&E when I got sober. I went back to the ARC and I gave them $500 cash. It's just something that I don't do. You know what I'm saying? Because when they told me it's going to cost you $500 to come in here, I said, I don't have it. Okay. But in my mind, my sponsor told me, he goes, you need to go back and make that right. And I did. I went back and made it right. And then I got a receipt and I showed him. Because we're liar, cheat, and thieves, you know what I mean? I could have lied and said, yeah, I took care of it, you know, the $500 in my pocket. But, you know, that's just the progression, and that's just the way this thing works. I wish I could sit here and say I had this fantastic relationship with my mom and my brother, but I don't. And it hurts. It hurts on a daily basis. I pray for her. I got a whole list of people that I pray for, and she's at the top of it. Now that I've seen Adam, you're going to be on my prayer list too. Just the way it is, man. Newcomers that I meet, I put you on my prayer list, and I pray for you in the morning. You get experience, strength, and hope that you keep coming back. Because that's what worked for me. I kept coming back. I did 90 and 90. My sponsor says you need to engulf yourself in this program, just like you engulfed yourself in drugs and alcohol. You need to just do it daily. You know, sometimes I'd go to 3 and 4 meetings a day. You know what I mean? I thought, oh my God, look at me. I'm doing 3 meetings a day. You know, and saying, oh, jeez, really? You're not special. You know, during this whole thing, I didn't go back in because there's a lot of stuff that I didn't go into. But I used to be a drummer, too. I was in 3 different bands back growing up when high school into my early youth, into my 20s. Early 25 and 30s, I was in bands. And I being a drummer, I played double basses. I had this beautiful set of drums. And I was self-taught. I was pretty good. I just have to say that. I was pretty good. I was wanted from a lot of people who played drums. But I shied away from it because every time you see a drummer or a guitar player, they're playing in a bar. And that's where it was leading me again. I thought, last year, I thought, you know what, I can do this again. So I pieced myself together this beautiful set of Ludwigs with Zildjian cymbals, and I started playing, and I started getting offers again. And I thought, oh my goodness, what am I going to do? Because everywhere they're playing in micro pubs up in Paso Robles. They're playing all over the place, and they're showing pictures of you know, drinking. And I just said, you know what? I love to play, but I'm just going to get out of that. So I've engulfed all of my energy into my quilting business, which I am a long arm quilter, and I have a long arm, so I do quilts. Baby quilts, lap quilts, king size, queens, you know, and I do some beautiful work, a lot of hand work, and just gorgeous stuff. And so that's where my serenity comes today. It comes from my hand work. It comes from my quilting. And I do woodworking too, but I don't do as much as I used to. I really enjoy working with material. And my wife is a designer, and she works with colors. She's amazing. So she can do what she can do, and I can do what I can do. But that's kind of what I do today. I hope you guys got something out of this. I was really nervous coming up here today. I haven't spoken 3 years. The last time I spoke was at a young people's meeting up in Atascadero. That was the last time I spoke, and I think that was 3.5 years ago. But COVID kind of took a lot of this, you know, one-on-one FaceTime. It took it away from us. But I think we're back. I really do. I've got all my shots, and me and my wife just got our boosters because of our immune systems are so screwed up. I would glove up and mask up, and, you know, and in alcohol. You know, when I shook hands, it was just so I wouldn't have to, I wouldn't take it home and give it to her because her immune system's so messed up. She ended up with breast cancer. I mean, it's just so many things that happened in her life. But I was there for her. I walked through that whole thing with breast cancer and chemotherapy, and I went through that whole thing with her. I was there for her. I'm there for her every day. I mean, that's just what I do. I got a little something that I just want to read real quick before. I think I got 4 minutes. This is something that a good friend of mine gave me, and he was a drug and alcohol counselor for many years. He stayed clean and sober for 14 years. He ended up relapsing, and he ended up dying at his bedside with his family around him. And he let me come, privileged to let me come. And he goes, I want you to take a picture of me and my family. And he goes, and I want you to share that with other alcoholics, like newcomers, and let them know what happens if you relapse. And he died of this disease, and he was, you know, it was terrible to watch him die like that. But he wrote this, and it means something to me. Okay, it goes, something you must know, hurt in order to know, fail in order to grow, lose in order to gain, because most of life's greatest lessons are learned through pain. Pain teaches us who we are. He wrote that on his deathbed, and I always end with that. I there's so many things I could have ended with, because I read page 83, and there's some stuff on 84 that I just love. A Vision for You is one of my favorites. That was wrote by Bill W. in 1947. It's just, God, I love A Vision for You. But with that, I want to thank Al again for letting me have this privilege to speak in front of you guys. I'm not as nervous now as I was when I started. Isn't that funny how that worked? But thank you so much, and God bless.
All right, let me get my eyes on. All right. Let's give Frank another hand.